Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Saturday morning, start out right, and boy, I'll tell you, it's an honor to do this show each and every Saturday. It's a Doc Talk podcast out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend of me, Dr. Greg Roscoe. Yours truly, producing it about 2,500 miles to the west, where it kind of looks like Seattle this morning. Mark Mancini here. 347-205-9631. If you happen to miss it, 60 minutes goes by quick. Catch the archive version, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcast, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more of him, less of me. Let me lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic to threes. Doc, how are you this morning? How can people get a hold of you? And boy, you're bringing another great guest back, Dr. Matt Varicello. I'll sit back, man the boards. I'll see you at the top of the hour with the questions, my friend.
Wow. Thank you again very, very much, Mark, for all your good work helping us produce this program. Things have been going well with the show. We've been getting some very excellent guests. And I can tell from the emails we have a lot of interest in the topics. And as you know, medicine has a variety of vocabulary, all kind of different aspects that, you know, we touch with our health. And, you know, going on, I have some very interesting guests coming on, but I have a superstar again this morning. We know the Varicella name, the Varicella family. Matt is the orthopedic surgeon with a lot of experience. He's a fellowship-trained, board-certified orthopedic surgeon. And, you know, today we wanted to, Matt, I'll get you right on. We wanted to talk a little more about ACL repairs and reconstructions. You know, we had talked a little bit ago about ACL, which is the anterior collateral ligament in the knee. We also have a little bit of a current event coming on today, and that's the Achilles tendon injury that Aaron Rodgers suffered, and he had surgery for repair. So Dr. Varicella is going to give us a little insight into his recuperation. You know, will he be back to play? But indeed, we have a couple of very interesting topics. And, you know, Matt, good morning, and thank you again for being on the show.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you. And, you know, Matt, you've been off for a couple of days. I know you're all over the world. But indeed, thank you again for helping us with this broadcast. You know, we and, you know, it's super. I get a lot of good response from you and from your listeners that love to hear about what you're talking about. And, you know, we started a little bit with this topic, you know, in the middle of our cancer sequence. And just to update our listeners, you know, next week we're going to talk about cancer of the voice box or cancer of the larynx. And I do have a world-class ear, nose, and throat head and neck cancer surgeon on next week to help discuss the symptoms, the diagnosis, as well as what can be done today to go ahead and preserve life, but also voice. Coming up in the near future, we're going to have also a president of a new hospital system, and he's going to talk about hospital care in the future. What does it look like? What should we be expecting from our hospitals? And then going on also, we want to have our 90-minute session, kind of completing the cancer workshops that we've done, talking about, you know, similarities in cancers, the differences, overall, what really helps them. And we're going to have a roundtable discussion, you know, with our presenters, giving us a little thumbnail sketch here, talking about similarities, differences, and maybe we can get some good information that would help one or two of our listeners. So without further ado, Matt Varicella, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about the NFL? About, you know, early season injuries with ACLs. And Matt, just kind of review a little bit with the ACL, where is it, what happens, and then let's go on to therapy. Can you help me?
Yeah, absolutely. So we touched on this on an earlier show regarding when athletes kind of get into that, the swing of things, and they're starting their season up in their practice. And a lot of times what we'll see as providers is we'll see a wave of injuries because the body's essentially deconditioned and the athlete's not used to performing at the same level as they are in season. So we also kind of touched on that's going to vary a little bit from professional and college ranks versus high school and obviously younger from that because they don't have access to all the resources kind of year-round. So when the season kind of starts up and the practices, that's usually we'll see a wave of those injuries. And, you know, we talked about the ACL last week, and just to kind of revisit that, ACL stands for anterior cruciate ligament. Cruciate meaning cross in the middle of the knee, and there are two ligaments that stabilize the knee, the femur on the tibia. So the femur is the thigh bone, the tibia is the shin bone. So what these ligaments do is they'll provide rotational stability, and they'll also provide stability from the bone shifting frontward and backward on them. So that's essentially a review of the anatomy there. And
man, how
you
tough?
Know, they're dense. Yeah, go ahead.
How tough are these ligaments? You know, are they big, thick ligaments, little thin ligaments?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of fibers.
Yeah, so,
you know, well, tell me about these ligaments.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was just about to mention that they're dense fibrous bands of tissue, and they're made up of collagen, and their biochemistry composition is essentially that is going to facilitate what that structure needs to do. So it's a little bit different than a tendon, a little bit different than the meniscus, and it's a little bit different than the cartilage.
Sure.
So when we kind of look at these structures, they're kind of built to perform the function that they need to do and obviously stabilize the knee. So, again, getting back to, we'll see that.
Matt.
Yeah, go ahead.
If I can, you know, with regard to, if we look at people in general, this ligament is important for walking, is it not? Our everyday stability of bending over, standing up, walking, turning corners, et cetera, correct?
Yeah, so that's it's an interesting point that you bring up because when an individual tears the ACL, what will happen is as long as they stay straight ahead, the knee actually can adapt and it can function relatively well. The problem is when that individual goes to change directions or tries to go side to side, or if it's an athlete, they're trying to pivot or cut, what will happen is because they don't have that rotational stability in the knee, they'll actually get the bones to shift on one another. Now, that can be pretty dangerous because it can damage the other structures in the knee. So that's why
they aren't used to carrying the load, man.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah.
Okay.
So you change the mechanics of the knee whenever that ligament is not functioning correctly. So we can get into this a little bit later, but that could entail a small sprain of the ligament. It could entail a partial tear of that ligament, so it's not functioning correctly. It may still have some of its integrity, but it's not functioning the way it needs to. And,
Matt,
you know, I talk about this with my brother. Yeah, go ahead.
I was mentioning going on with regard to these injuries we're seeing in the NFL. I think you've alluded to that. You said the word sprain. You've also said the word tear or rupture. What's the difference here?
So
is that an important thing?
No, it is, absolutely, because if an individual is normally when an individual injures their ACL, it's going to be a non-contact, meaning nobody runs into them. They just plant, and maybe they go to cut or pivot, and that knee will kind of buckle and shift. And that's what compromises the ligament. So, again, you mentioned it could be a sprain, whereas if the mechanism is not as strong as one to create a complete rupture, you might just get a small sprain of that ligament where it gets a little injured, or you could get a partial tear. So the ACL
is
actually made up of two strong bundles. And a lot of times what I'll see in a partial injury or a partial tear is one of those bundles off the femur or the thigh bone.
Okay.
And and then we kind of get into how that individual adapts in that type of situation, because sometimes if an individual is what we call a coper, their muscular constitution around their So that's actually a clinical term that is used throughout the literature in terms of athletes or patients that partially injure their ACL or even fully rupture their ACL, depending on the activity they have to do, depending on how the muscles and tendons are around the knee. Maybe they have good muscular control otherwise. Those structures can sometimes make up for that lack of function for the ACL. And that's a smaller percentage of people, because most people, once that ruptures or if they have a high-grade sprain, a lot of times that ends up needing surgically addressed. But it's kind of, we've always kind of found that very interesting in terms of individuals being able to adapt and function with a decent portion of their ACL missing, essentially.
So, Matt, what you're saying, in essence, is we have other structures there in the knee that could actually help to accommodate this tear and go ahead and help our patients still function pretty well overall.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. One of the structures that comes to mind, and we can talk about this a little bit later, but it's the hamstrings.
Sure, go ahead.
Where they insert, the hamstrings actually come down. They start at the top, kind of around the buttock area, and they run down the back of your thigh, and then they kind of wrap around the inside part of your knee and attach at the top of the shin bone. One of the things that we always see in an individual that injures their ACL is that the hamstrings will flare up because they are actually compensating for that lack of an ACL. They try to stabilize that shin bone. So that's something we see in almost everybody.
And Matt, other structures compensating, are they becoming weaker? Are they becoming less functional? Is this a future problem for this patient?
So that's actually a really good question and something that we're always looking at, because in some individuals, they're able to cope and it doesn't compromise their overall function or cause problems with their muscles and tendons long term. However, in the majority of people that have this long term compromise for years and years building up, that can actually lead to what we would call, for example, tendinopathy, where the tendon starts to deteriorate. It'll get tendonitis kind of off and on, and then the body tries to heal it with that inflammation, but it puts down not normal tissue, and it'll put down some scar tissue. So that starts to build up over time, and it replaces the normal tissue. So we're talking about Achilles later on. That's one of the mechanisms for Achilles ruptures, because the tendon gets compromised long-term and it'll build kind of wear and tear. That's why usually those ruptures will happen in 40s to 60s, because it takes a little bit of time for that to build up. And it also depends on so many other factors, but yeah.
Sure. And, you know, I just got an email here. Does cold weather make these athletes, everyday people, more susceptible to these kind of injuries? Is cold weather an issue?
So it is. And there are ways to kind of combat that and actually go about, you know, stretching, warming up. The way to think about it is the worst situation is if you're going out to a practice and you're not warming up and you're just jumping right in and it's extremely cold weather, your body doesn't get a chance to kind of get going and get the blood flowing. And that does set people up for injuries, because you also think about whenever it's really cold outside and, for example, you're shivering, you're actually taking away from the energy that otherwise would go to preventing your body from injury or for example, like doing the functions you need to do. So it absolutely plays a role there.
And, you know, Matt, along that same line, you know, we know these athletes pay a hell of a price for what they're doing and their life and lifestyle. With regard to kind of, you know, looking at a little trauma, another little trauma, you know, then another little trauma over years, does that predispose these tendons to more serious damage or more readiness to tear or rupture because of the, say, history of these micro traumas?
Yeah, I always actually tell some of my patients that it's a ticking time bomb because that's building up over time. The classic one that I see is overhead laborers that are using their rotator cuff muscles. And that eventually catches up with you. That tendon starts to break down, maybe you get small micro tears in it. The body tries to heal it, but it's not normal tissue that it's putting down. Well, that tissue that it's trying to heal itself with is actually weaker. So it'll stress the area right next to it and cause more problems in that area. And that's where you end up getting, say, a small tear will go to a larger tear. But, yeah, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head with how it's a wear and tear situation in a lot of these injuries. Now, an ACL is a little bit different because that's an acute ligament rupture. It's usually an event that will happen, although there are a lot of risk factors that can predispose somebody to having an ACL injury. But the difference with a lot of those ligament injuries versus tendon is a lot of times the tendon, it's kind of building up over time.
Sure. Matt, that's excellent rendition. You know, Matt, if we're going on, you know, I want to skip ahead a little bit. We've done, you know, you've done last time our pillar one, getting the history, pillar two, examining, you know, pillar three, any diagnostic testing, then, of course, decision-making. You know, if we're in pillar four here with decision-making, and you're saying, you know what, that tendon is torn, there's no way to rehab you, you're going to need to have surgery. Matt, what are the opportunities here for healing? What are the options for surgery? You know, people talk about stem cell therapy. They talk about a lot of these modern, you know, the platelet-rich plasma. Tell us about, you know, conservative versus more serious therapy, but we can get this patient to heal. And say an athlete, Matt, what if we have a young athlete, 16-year-old, tore the ACL? You know, what are you going to do for this athlete, Matt? Can you help us?
Yeah. Well, so here's what's interesting is you always pair it with the history, what exactly happened. A lot of times with these injuries, you hear an audible pop. And we didn't talk about this last time, but the gold standard of imaging is you would get an X-ray of the knee or the part of the body that's injured, and then getting an MRI, which is a detailed look at the soft tissues. And that's how you can diagnose these ligamentous injuries or these tendon injuries.
Sure. Matt, now you're going to accompany that with also your physical exam. I want to stress that a little bit. So you're just not saying, hey, go get an MRI. You're actually touching the patient in this process, coming to a conclusion. Am I correct?
Absolutely. So it's always the biggest thing that we can do in medicine, no matter how busy you get or how crazy your day is, you always have to remember to examine the patient. And the classic example of that would be if there is a, for example, a partial ACL rupture. Well, if you examine that knee, you can get a sense of the stability that the knee has. And you can also get an overall sense of how that individual's alignment is. For example, so if somebody injures their ACL, and certainly if they injure their ACL a second time, a lot of times we look at their alignment. Are they significantly knock-kneed or bowed? So that's kind of where I'll start, and I'll look at how they're walking into the room, look for cuts, abrasions, things like that. And then
Matt,
the biggest thing from
can you tell by the way they walk if they've had a chronic injury or something's acute? Are you able to diagnose it based on just plain walking?
Yeah, that's a lot of times you'll kind of see a difference in their in their walking pattern, but that could be a multitude of reasons. That could be a ton of different things. Usually,
okay,
somebody that has an ACL injury, the things that I'm always looking at are, do they come in a wheelchair? Do they come in with crutches? Do they just walk straight in? Sometimes
sure,
when you have an ACL injury that's 2 months, 2 or 3 months old, the patient, especially if they've done some physical therapy, they're able to walk into the room. And like I said, if
got
they
it,
stay straight, they're going to be okay. But as soon as they go to change direction, so a lot of times with an ACL, chronic one, you'll notice that the patient is actually making a conscious effort to stay straight in line and not make any side-to-side moves. So that's an interesting
thing
to pick up on.
So that's a good physical characteristic that, you know, you or your nurse practitioners or PAs would no doubt want to look at, correct, when you're training them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, let's go on to a little bit of surgery. I know I've had several emails about, tell me about the surgery for ACL. I know you do a lot of good results. People are coming to you for these repairs and then, you know, rehabilitation because the repairs seem to be working. Would you mind elaborating on that?
Sure. So really, and this is actually my favorite surgery to do, and we do a lot of them here. Unfortunately, I always say that, unfortunately for the athletes, because that means a lot of people are getting injured. But the surgery in and of itself is technically an arthroscopic procedure, meaning I'm using a camera, and that's facilitating my visualization in the knee. Now, there is an open part to it because especially in younger athletes, you replace the ACL with a tendon. And that's probably the most fascinating part about the procedure, at least from my perspective, because you're taking a tendon and putting it in place of a ligament. And then when that athlete rehabs with physical therapy, their athletic trainers, eventually over time, the microscopic constitution of that tendon turns into a ligament. It's really a fascinating thing. It's called ligamentization.
Wow. And how long does that take to happen, that conversion? Are we talking months?
Yeah, usually anywhere from 4 to 7 months, actually, depending on the type of therapy they get.
Sure.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves with that part, but that's the theory behind our ACL program with rehabbing very aggressively, is potentially that tendon is turning into a ligament sooner because you're loading it earlier and more
aggressively. And Matt, is that something that you've helped devise or improve with your practice and your research and your surgical techniques?
Yeah, that's been one of the most influential elements of our practice. And I work really closely with my athletic trainer, Dr. Sam Morgan, and she's come up with a very detailed timeline of how we can aggressively rehab these athletes. And our whole goal, and this is something that every program kind of struggles with across the country, is how can you standardize the rehab, and then before that athlete goes back to play, there's a standard set of tests that they have to pass, and they have to hit certain marks, and if they don't hit them, they don't get cleared. So they have to hit them. And that's, again, you know, kind of getting a little ahead of ourselves, but I have a ton of athletes that pass these numbers, that pass these tests very quickly. But kind of want to touch on the surgery a little bit more, if you don't mind.
Yes, please. Would like to hear about that, please.
Yeah, so the open part is when you're taking the tendon, and like I said, if it's a younger athlete, the gold standard is actually to take what we call an autograft, auto meaning self. So you're taking that tendon. Now, it could be the quad tendon, it could be the patellar tendon, it could be the hamstrings.
And where, if you will, for our audience, where is the site? What is the site of the autograft? Can you help me?
Yes. Well, it depends on the tendon or the site that you're taking from. But so if you're taking the quad tendon, you are right at the top of the kneecap. And if you're taking the patellar tendon, you're right kind of below that kneecap area. So you'll have
an incision.
So it's
in the knee area
in that
overall.
Area. Yep. Yeah.
And how much?
And then the hamstring.
I understand. I don't want to interrupt. It's excellent. And I'm just wondering for our audience.
You're right.
How much, if we're talking about a graft, how big a piece of tissue are you harvesting? You know, are we talking about a 3-inch piece or a 1/2-inch piece? Can you tell us about that?
That's a good point, because that'll vary in size, and it'll vary depending on the graft that's used. There is a standard number that you're kind of shooting for, anywhere from like high 50 millimeters to like 65 millimeters to do what it needs to do in the knee. And there's, when you take that tendon from the patient, there's a whole graft prep process where you're suturing it together, making it look like, making it essentially facilitating it to function like a ligament. And then you have to hook these fixation devices to it. So when you go to insert the graft, that's how you kind of dock it to get that time, that fixation right at the end of the procedure. We call it time zero.
And, you know, Matt, along that line, that sounds pretty darn sophisticated. How do you assess that in somebody growing? Will this graft grow with the patient and maintain a certain length, or is it something that needs to be revised? Could you look at that for me?
So in most situations, even individuals that have some growth left, and again, this kind of gets onto the topic of pediatric ACLs, a lot of times, if it's a younger patient, they are not going to rupture their ACL. They'll actually rupture the part of the bone where the ACL inserts at the top of the shin bone, because that's the weakest point. So that part aside, I do see a fair amount of adolescence, or maybe you have like a year and a half or a year of growth remaining. And in those situations, there's not a significant change in the dynamics of the knee in terms of where that graft is positioned. Now, I have seen some cases over the years, not mine, but where individuals had significant growth spurts after, and that did affect the ACL graft. But that's not a standard situation.
Sure. Hey, Matt, I'm going to hold you up right there. You know, Mr. Mancini has many questions. I just have one, if I can preempt Mr. Mancini. I have a question from California, L.A., where they're asking, once you have an ACL injury in a graft, are you predisposed to continue to have a damage in that knee if you want to be an athlete?
Yeah, that's a topic I could talk about for hours, but I always say you have one time that you want to do that correctly. I say to my patients, it's one and done. So we have them do prehab, where they're doing physical therapy before the surgery. The surgery is perfect, and then afterwards they're doing really aggressive, essentially 5 to 7 days a week of physical therapy.
Wow.
I have some of my athletes that are doing that for 4 or 5 hours a day. They're crazy, but it's they have fantastic outcomes. You always want to do that correctly the first time. And that's why we're always looking at these tests when an athlete is going to go back to sport. My set of tests that I use, I want them to be within 10% of their normal knee. So they're uninjured knee. And this is a whole series of tests where they're doing a lot of dynamic things. They're you know, vertical testing. They're running a mile. They're doing a plank. Like, there are a lot of different things. But it's all to target a comprehensive approach, so when they return to sport, they have the smallest chance possible of re-injuring. So if we look at the data with ACL injuries, anywhere from 8% to 25% of individuals within the first 2 years after an ACL injury, an ACL reconstruction, they either re-injure the same side or they injure the other side. That's kind of based on the literature. We are obviously constantly working at bringing that number down, but that's been a number for decades that has kind of plagued ACL reconstructions, which is why this topic...
Got it.
And this technique we've been doing is very exciting, because it's cutting down on those numbers significantly.
So you're getting better results for your patients, returning to their prior level of activity or sport. Matt, I'd like to go to the studio with Mark Mancini. Mr. Mancini, Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, let me get a couple of these, get you back to the interview there as it picks up steam here. Lou coming in from Visalia, California. He goes, Matt, is there any way to prepare when you tear your ACL? Is it just a lack of training? Is it overworking muscles? How do you prepare not to tear an ACL? I notice sometimes with a rotator cuff, I'm not throwing stuff, but my rotator cuff went out. Is it just straining it? Great question out of Visalia.
Yeah, that is a great question. And the answer is all the above, because we've always been looking at this. How can you do injury prevention programs? It's hard to get the insurance companies on board with that, but really that is how you prevent or help reduce the rate of those patients coming in, athletes coming in to the office with these injuries. So what I always tell my patients in that situation is I go, okay, you're here, you have this injury, I want to make it so you're never back here again, and I never have to bring you back on the table or operate on you again. So you kind of lay the foundation with that, and you start to prepare them mentally, because something else we always tap into, again, I could talk about this for hours too, is the mental aspect of the injury. 100% of athletes that have this type of knee injury, rupture their ACL, rupture their Achilles, there is a mental component, and there will be several mental hurdles that they have to jump over when they are recovering from this injury and this surgery. And there's a great quote from Kobe Bryant where he's talking about how, you know, you're just sitting back and you're looking at what are the baby goals that I get after the surgery. Like, I'm learning to walk again. I'm learning to go up the steps. Like, all these mini wins, that's, you just focus on a day at a time. And then I always kind of say you'll have a good day, bad day, then you have a good day, a couple bad days. But the overall trajectory is you're looking at an improved outcome kind of week to week at that point. And, yeah, with that whole goal of we never want to have to operate on you again, I never want to see you back in my office again. Let's get it done one time. Let's do it right, and I never have to see you again.
And can I interrupt 1 second? Hey, Matt, do you ever tell your patients, I don't want you playing football again. Career's over. You know, you're not going to kick a soccer ball. I don't want you out jogging again or running again. Are there cases that you have to say your career's over?
Well, we talk about that comment that came in, I think it was Los Angeles too, was the revision situation or the ruptured ACL graft. Once an individual's on that second or third injury, you start to do more and more damage to the joint. And one of my mentors, when I was in fellowship, he would always say, you know, she really needs to retire because her knee retired years ago. And there's a lot of truth to that statement because, you know, the athletes, they love their sport, but there's also the aspect of you have to think about your knee long term. And regardless of how good the surgeon is and technique and the physical therapy, eventually that type of injury, especially ACL revisions, that starts to catch up with you with time, for sure.
Got it.
But
very good.
I just
want to
kind of
answer
a little bit more there. So sometimes parents will tell me, or they'll want me to kind of advocate for them to not do a certain sport. I try to really refrain from doing anything like that. I don't want to adjust anybody's lifestyle. I want, because if you're holding somebody out from something that they love to do, there's a psychological component to that too, depression, mental health issues, all
sure.
of that. So I always try to push for, get back to doing what you want to do. The classic one around here is dirt biking. I see a ton of ACLs from dirt bike accidents. Now, I want to tell all of them, just don't get back on the dirt bike. That's one situation, but
sure.
you can't convince them otherwise.
Got it. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, let me throw one more, and I'll get it back to you. Gary from Duluth, Minnesota, comes in and basically says, guys, a great show as always. With the ACLs, why does it take a year for it to get better? You see a lot of these athletes going down. How come the prognosis takes a year? And then sometimes if they tear it, it's another year. So it looks like it's taken, 365 days a year just to heal this injury.
Yeah. Yeah, and that gets back to the basic science of how that tendon turns into a ligament. And we're going off a little bit of antiquated data, meaning a dated literature. I think it's time to update that. But that's part of the technique that we're doing. We're putting so when I do the technique, we could talk about this another day too, is I take the bone marrow out of the top of the shin bone, and then we spin it down, and it has stem cells and growth factors. Well, we mix that together with some bone to help to stimulate the knee to heal faster. That's kind of the idea behind that. And when you do that special type of procedure called the fertilized ACL, the whole idea is that you get the tunnels to heal faster. Now, the tunnels have to be created in the knee in order to have some place to put the graft. So that's why we have to drill these small tunnels there. Well, the downside to having to drill those tunnels is that those tunnels may not heal. And they may not heal in somebody who's 17 years old or 25 years old.
Wow.
It all depends on a ton of different factors. So when those tunnels don't heal, the problem is that the graft will have some micromotion, and it won't fully heal as well too. So we target those tunnels to heal, because if you get good tunnel healing, then in theory, the graft, the ACL graft, starts to revascularize quicker. Revascularizing meaning blood flow gets back to the graft. The earlier the blood flow gets restored, and we've taken some people back in, 4 to 6 weeks afterwards, and we've seen rapid acceleration of the graft healing, just in some of these anecdotal second looks. So when that blood supply gets restored to the graft, then you couple it with the aggressive physical therapy. When that tendon put in place for that ligament, when it starts to get loaded with physical therapy, running, just range of motion exercises, doing cutting back and forth, eventually over time, that collagen, which makes up the tendon structure, it'll reorganize and actually microscopically look like a ligament. And that's the ligamentization process, which takes anywhere from 3 to 4 months up to like 6 to 7 months. But that's the idea behind the 9 to 12 month return to sport time frame, is because when we look at what's going on microscopically inside the knee when that athlete's rehabbing, we don't want to send them back out there when the tendon is still a tendon and it hasn't become a ligament. So that's kind of the thought behind that.
Sure. Mark, you know what? You mentioned the word tunnels. If we can just define that a little bit, you're talking about where you're actually making an opening in the bone to secure the ligament. Am I correct? So it's a tunnel for some type of wire, some type of suture?
Yeah, so it's really slick the way we do the technique. We'll take a smaller pin and actually drill from the outside part of the bone into the knee joint, so from outside in. It's a couple millimeters, this pin. Well, when you're harvesting that graft, when you're taking that tendon from that patient, I mentioned the length. The diameter of it is anywhere from 8.5 millimeters up to like 10.5 millimeters. So you have to create a little socket to dock that graft. It actually has to go inside that tunnel in order to promote healing. So the slick part about the technique is that you're not taking as much bone as you otherwise would have had to with the old techniques, because we used to use big drills, and you would drill from outside in and you would take all this bone. And now we've kind of adapted to taking less from that standpoint, only taking what you have to in order to dock that graft. And then, and that's also that area where that bone marrow ends up going, and to kind of jumpstart the healing process. Yeah.
Mark, you know what? We could go on with these repairs. I'd like to have you back. Your repair technique sounds fantastic, and I know you've gotten athletes back far quicker than other people have. I think that's a show I'd like to go on in the future.
Yeah.
You know, as far as what I wanted to kind of finish today, if you don't mind, I want to talk about Aaron Rodgers. about this Achilles tendon rupture that he did suffer and then had it repaired surgically several days later. Do you want to go into a little bit of that with regard to this Achilles tendon? Now, my understanding is this is the largest tendon in the body, correct?
Yep.
It's a big piece of tissue. And, so, you know, athletes can – go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it gets back to our point of I didn't interview Aaron Rodgers, but I don't believe that he was having bouts of Achilles tendonitis, meaning pain back at that Achilles tendon that was kind of off and on. That can be a risk factor for this developing.
Sure.
But his mechanisms, it's usually what we would call an eccentric load, meaning the tendon tries to lengthen as it gets tension. And if you catch that just right, as he did, that obviously causes the rupture. And it's all, I always go back to when Kevin Durant had his rupture too, and certainly Aaron Rodgers, you can actually see the muscle belly shoot up into the calf when somebody has this rupture. And it's usually a characteristic way they walk. We talked about how they ACLs walk into the office. An Achilles tendon is very, very classic because they can't push off. Because that Achilles tendon, it attaches the calf muscle down to the heel bone. So if you fire that muscle, it's going to flex the foot down, and that allows you to push off. So what they'll do is they'll come in, and they're kind of walking flat-footed, maybe swinging it out to the side. But that's one of the most classic things that you'll see. The big,
you know, as far as
other, go ahead.
I was just going to mention, you know, along with this topic, I had several emails this week. And, you know, with regard to that Achilles tendon, and they talked about a rupture, where does it tear? You know, now in this particular situation, being an NFL quarterback and, you know, being hit and then no doubt jostled around a bit here, where would this thing tear, so to speak, that this gentleman would need to have surgery?
Yeah, so it's typically 4 to 6 centimeters above where the heel bone inserts, so kind of that musculotendinous junction where the muscle tapers into a tendon structure and then attaches to the bone. That is notoriously a very an area of low blood flow, and that's going to obviously lead to compromised healing, and that's going to predispose somebody to rupture there. So,
well, you know,
Just
along this, which I know you know about, with regard to, I had several emails, could this be a career-ending injury for this NFL quarterback at his age, which is, you know, he's in the early 40s?
Yeah, I mean, he's 39, so he, that is an area of great debate. However, if you've listened to how he's talking, I think he just went on for his first interview after his repair, but he was basically saying, you know, I'm going to come back stronger. I don't care what anybody says about this. This gets back to the mental edge of that. That certainly plays a huge component. Here he was, you know, 4 plays into his first game as a New York Jet, ready to kind of take off in this season. I mean, that's just a tremendous stroke of bad luck. But he's approaching it the right way. He got surgery very quickly. You want to do surgery within 4 to 6 weeks, kind of at the latest for something like this. That's usually the kind of the rule of thumb with tendon ruptures, because if you wait too long, it starts to scar in. It doesn't heal as well. The tissue starts to degenerate. So he had surgery kind of at an ideal time. He went to Dr. Neil Elitrosh, who's a pretty famous orthopedic surgeon. He's operated on tons of athletes, and, you know, obviously had a good surgery, and he's approaching it the right way. There are a couple different ways to fix this. Do you want me to kind of go over that?
Yes,
or
I'd like
that
you to, as far as, do we know, I haven't heard specifically, do we know what kind of a repair was undertaken on this?
Well, I actually don't know directly, but you could look at, if you ever catch a glimpse at his incision. There's basically 2 ways to do this. There's a straight up and down incision. That's kind of more of the old school technique. And you'll open the, kind of go down through the skin and suture the ends of the tendon together. The other technique, which is less invasive, it's a small horizontal incision. It's called the PAR system. But what that is, again, it's minimally invasive, and there are no knots that you have to tie. And you kind of, it's pretty slick. And so what you end up doing is you go right to the area where the rupture is, go a little bit above that, and then you put this device inside the calf, and then it feeds a bunch of sutures through the muscle belly, and then you pull it down, and you actually fixate it with a couple anchors into the heel bone. And you want to tension that correctly, so when that tendon heals, that athlete's able to push off. Because if you don't tension it correctly, then his function is not going to be where it needs to be. So you also touched upon, well, we could talk about return to sport because that is a very interesting area. They've done a bunch of studies in NBA players. And although most people return, they don't return the same. And there's a ton of athletes in that situation. There's Kobe Bryant, Dominique Wilkins, the list goes on and on, Larry Bird. It's usually about three quarters from an NBA standpoint. The number's pretty similar with NFL. And
wow.
the question is, though, are they able to get back to their same level of performance? And typically the answer is no. However, I'm not going to say Aaron Rodgers is not
sure
going to get there. A lot of it's going to be his mentality, how he kind of fights through this. And, some of it's also biology, too, because at his age, he's not going to be healing as fast as he would have maybe 10 years ago. But I do think that his mentality is that he's going to be back on the field. So that's
which
what matters
good
to me.
Yeah, for many, many reasons. You know, as far as predisposing factors, in an athlete like this, he's been a superstar in many, many years. And no doubt, Matt, he works out. He warms up. He would know all those things, would he not? Would his trainers not have him doing all the appropriate preparation?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's that as opposed to maybe more of a stroke of bad luck. Again, if I interviewed him, I would wonder if he was having some predisposing symptoms. Maybe he was having pain off and on at his kind of the heel bone area. The other classic way that this often presents is what we call the weekend warrior situation where, for example, I haven't played basketball in a while, but the thing that always holds me up from going out and playing pickup on a random Saturday is because I'm not doing that routinely. So if I go out and I try to play, especially the older I get, the more you're predisposed to injuring that and rupturing it. I had a good friend that actually did that. We were studying for boards together and we went to play basketball and he literally went up for a layup and you heard it pop throughout the gym. It happens left and right. I know a bunch of people that are like that. When somebody asks me if I'm playing basketball, I'm always like, no, I'm worried about rupturing my Achilles because it'll put me down.
In your career. You know, what we want to do, we'll let our listeners know, we're going to have Mark Mancini get a hold of Aaron Rodgers, and maybe we can get him on the show to talk about this. Mark,
that'd
what do you
beautiful
think?
Yeah, that would be a great one. I mean, I'll tell you, we haven't seen two great quarterbacks in Green Bay now. Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers are leaving, and we got the Jordan Love era, and that reminds me of the Lynn Dickey days, so who knows that one. Let me get to some of these comments. Joey from Bucks County.
Go ahead.
Let me get a couple more in here before I know we'll do an overview of the show. Joey from Bucks County, PA, basically says, when you look at the ACL, is that the strongest ligament in the knee?
It is, yeah. Yeah, and especially with its function. It's the way to think about it is it's essentially the most critical in terms of stability. I don't know if, you know, people listen to this. If you've had a friend that's ruptured their PCL, which is the sister ligament to the ACL, a lot of times the knee can get by, actually majority of situations, when the PCL ruptures. But the ACL is so critical that that's why we have to reconstruct it. Now, it also has poor blood supply, and that is also why, and I didn't touch on this earlier, but when an individual sprains it or partially tears it, the ligament does not heal as well as, say, for example, the MCL or the LCL, which are on the inside and outside part of the knee, and they kind of stabilize your knee from going inward and outward. The location of those structures, they have better blood supply, and that's why a lot of times if an individual just injures their MCL, they don't need surgery.
Got it. Go ahead,
well,
Mark.
Steve from Corvallis, Oregon, and I'll try to get one more after this one. How do you tell if an ACL is torn or sprained? Water in the knee, would that tell you something if you get that? Because I've heard of that topic, he says. I've heard of water in the knee, too.
Yeah, we talk about water in the knee like every weekend, I feel like. It's so common. Typically, when you see that situation, if the quote-unquote water is coming from inside the knee, and that just takes obviously years to kind of get that expertise down and feeling where the water and fluid is, that's one thing that kind of clues you in. A partial ACL sometimes can generate that, what we call an effusion, but it's not going to be as much as, say, a complete rupture. And I've actually had a lot of athletes that completely rupture their ACL, and they barely have any effusion or water on their knee. So it kind of varies from person to person, but classically it does cause the swelling. The other thing that clues you in is really that clinical exam. There's a physical examination maneuver called the Lockman test, where you kind of grab the thigh bone, grab the thigh, and then you try to shift the tibia or the shin bone forward. And then you obviously compare it to the normal side, because you'll actually, after you do a ton of them, you'll get really good in terms of sensing that laxity, that degree of laxity, because the ACL is going to prevent that shin bone from shifting forward. So if you're able to dramatically shift it forward, then you know most likely that the ACL is out.
Wow.
Let me take one.
Does that help?
Let me take one.
Mark?
Oh,
go ahead.
Yeah, let me take one more, and then I'll have you guys do an overview as we're approaching the six-minute mark. Albert from Poway, another regular listener, basically says, guys, can you still walk with a damaged ACL? Wow.
Yeah. So that's one of the – yeah, that's that situation where – and if you saw me, you know how I'm demonstrating this, but you got to stay straight in line, and then if you go to turn direction, you have to literally turn, take these small shuffle steps, and then – go essentially 90 degrees from there. But that's how the body kind of compensates from that. Now, depending on what an individual has to do, there are a lot of people walking around out there with high-grade partial ACL tears or maybe no ACL at all. Sometimes what will happen is you get arthritis in the knee, and the arthritis actually creates scar tissue, and it stabilizes the femur and the shin bone. So that can actually make up for it sometimes, and that's something that we obviously look at too. So the long story short is that if it's a younger athlete and they've ruptured their ACL, you're obviously going to fix that in almost all situations, because you want to stabilize the knee and prevent secondary damage to the meniscus or the cartilage. But it gets into an interesting discussion when individuals are, you know, over 45. I've done ACLs and people up until, I think, 66 years old was the oldest one I did. She's very active individual, hikes out west. She's a yoga instructor. So it comes down to, you know, individualized medicine. I'm treating that person based on what they're doing, what they need to do. You know, do they already have arthritis? Sometimes when people tear their ACL and they already have arthritis, sometimes a knee replacement is the answer. It all kind of depends on the situation there.
Wow.
Wow.
Very interesting practice. Go ahead, Mark. Do you have something else?
Yeah, no, I was going to, with less than 4 minutes, if you want to do a quick overview, let everybody know how they can get a hold of you, Matt. Doc will also promote next week's show, and we'll put a wrap on this.
Good.
Yeah. So, again,
go ahead. Matt,
how
do people get a hold of you?
So email is mavaracallo at phhealthcare.org. Phone number is 814-375-6200. I'm also on social media as well, too.
And, Matt, what's the sweet spot for your practice? What do you love to do? What do you do best? Where can you give patient care the best?
I'd say the top two are the ACL reconstructions. That's definitely the wheelhouse. And then robotic joint replacements, robotic-assisted joint replacements. So,
wonderful.
Yeah, those are the two.
Well, Mark, I'm going to wrap this up from my standpoint.
Okay.
I want to thank Dr. Varicella for the excellent review, as well as giving us, you know, several weeks now, several sessions of good information. You know, I want to bring a current event in as well. And you know what? Maybe, Mark, you can get Aaron Rodgers on for us so we can talk to him about his surgery. All right.
I got a lot of connections, but I'll have to really dip into the pill for that one.
See what you can do. I know you can do it.
I have faith in
you. Yes. And, you know, as far as our next show, we're talking about voice box cancer. You know, when do we take the voice box out? When don't we? You know, how can we save the voice box? That's next week. Very interesting discussion. Finishing up our cancer series. And then we're going to talk about hospital care of the future. And then we're going to have our roundtable with our cancer specialist, maybe giving us a little bit of insight into the future of cancer care. People can get a hold of me, GJRMD. 308 at outlook.com. I've been getting a lot of emails. There's a lot of interest, and I thank my listeners very, very much. And I thank you, Mr. Mancini, as well, for your production skills. Thank you.
Oh, I love you guys, too. Matt Varicello out there along with you, Dr. Greg Roscoe. And I know next week it's going to be a great guest as well. Real fast, do you want to tell us about that guest next week as we start to wind this out?
Yes, I have a head and neck cancer surgeon that is world class. He's trained all over the world, as well as comes from New York City in one of the big cancer hospitals where he trained, where he did research on cancer of the voice. Currently is in active practice with a huge practice, but has a lot of research with regard to the voice box and taking care of this. And that's Dr. Elias Hillal. H-I-L-L-A-L. Excellent speaker, very good communicator. What an excellent surgeon. He has tremendous results in salvage care of the larynx, as well as doing partial surgeries on the larynx in order to keep our patients talking. So it should be an excellent show. And again, we'll be taking questions. If you want to email me this week with your questions, that would be great. But that's what I have going on for next week, Mark.
Yeah, and we'll let the listeners know. It could be a half an hour early, depending on time. If not, regular scheduled time next week. Till then, have a blessed one. And I wish I was out there with the boys in Pittsburgh. The Yankees are in Pittsburgh this weekend in Monday Night Football with the Browns and Steelers. It'd be a great weekend in the Berg. For those guys out there, yours truly in Los Angeles, have a blessed one. Thanks for tuning in. Catch the archive version, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports. We'll talk to you next week, guys.
Thank you all very much.